Podcast. I am your host, Tim Hemming, and for today's show, we've got Pete North on from the Leave Alliance. This interview is a little bit longer than normal, but I really hope you stick with us for it. Pete gives some really valuable and deep insight into the world of Brexit. He is very clearly a man who lives and breathes his politics. So although it perhaps gets a bit intense at times, I do think there is some real value in listening to this one. That was just a note before we get started. But as always, thank you ever so much for listening. Really appreciate all the feedback you've been giving us on social media as well. That's been great. Now we've passed 100 shows. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand you over to, this is myself and Pete North. And welcome back, everybody, to today's Brexit podcast. And I've got a special guest with me today. It's Pete North from Leave Alliance. Welcome to the show, Pete.
Hello.
Thanks for popping in. So, Pete, all the way from Bristol, so come up for this one. First question, Pete. Doing a bit of research on you. What's the Leave Alliance all about, and what in the world is Flexit, which you've proposed?
Well, the Leave Alliance was an independent campaign. We always felt that it would need to be lots of independent small units going out and talking to their own constituencies. But in a lot of respects, we were a special operations group where we were out there recruiting bloggers to our particular cause and priming them to say, look, there are ways of leaving the EU. That aren't going to cause this economic catastrophe that everybody's talking about. And the big issue of the early campaign was the absence of a plan, the complexity of leaving, and while the main campaign always had the sort of positive spin on it, and to a certain extent Panglossian nonsense, we need to be able to realistically say that, look, we're aware of the issues, we're aware of the technicalities, we have thought it through. And by recruiting bloggers, we were able to, just with a handful of us, we were able to round on journalists on Twitter and force Flexit, which was okay. our Brexit plan, force them to say, all right, there is a plan in existence, and to effectively widen the debate.
So just so I'm clear, a vote leave group.
Yes.
Right. But one that is not, does not align itself with the vote leave campaign as such, and says there has to be more of a plan going forward, and a note of realism perhaps.
Well, vote leave, i.e. vote leave limited, they were very much a Westminster-based campaign, very much Tory-led. They had their own ideas. They were completely exclusive. It was going to be their message only, and they weren't going to include anybody else. And their deliberate tactic was to keep it as vague as possible. So we've still got this debate as to whether Vote Leave did or didn't say we were going to leave the single market. And because they had no message discipline and no particular line, you've got Owen Paterson saying, you know, well, only a madman would think about leaving the market. But then you've got Gisela Stewart saying that we absolutely must. So there was never any focus or even an appreciation of the issues from Vote Leave, and we always strongly thought that they were running a weak campaign, and we need to be able to say, look, it's not so much leaving that will cause all of these problems and all the economic harm. It's a question not of whether we leave, but how we leave. And so we marked out several roadmaps for doing that, one of them being the European Economic Area, otherwise known as the Single Market. And we looked at the EEA agreement, and one thing it is, it's not set in stone. They say, you know, you can't pick and choose and you can't cherry pick from the single market. Well, it's like the old saying, you can't break the laws of physics, but you can bend them. Mm-hmm. And the way the EEA agreement is set out, it's like a one-to-many database relationship where you have the core entity of the agreement that everybody subscribes to, but then there's country-specific protocols, and then there's annexes and reservations where the agreement can be tailored for specific circumstances. And then, of course, there's the question of freedom of movement, which there are safeguards within the agreement that can be triggered that then set off a political process not entirely dissimilar to Article 50. It sort of compels a response to the unilateral triggering of Article 112. So that would then start up a debate as to how we were going to re-engineer freedom of movement while still being able to maintain the basics of frictionless trade.
Okay, so you're describing your Flexit plan really now moving forward. So having described some of that, what are you actually proposing that should happen?
Well, we've always had people misrepresenting Flexit as being the Norway option. Well, we always said that Flexit is a six-stage plan whereby the first part of leaving is just to deal with the legal engineering and the mechanics of Article 50. That in effect is the Norway option, but that's just kind of the departure lounge rather than the destination. Where we then, once we get settled in and we've got all the legal wrangling out of the way, that's when we start looking at the immigration issues, which of course are not strictly limited to freedom of movement. With Brexit, we get our international right of initiative back, and what we actually need to be doing is looking at the asylum processes under the 51 Geneva Convention on Refugees. So that's what really crucially is the bit that needs reforming. So we didn't put too much of an emphasis, as UKIP did, on freedom of movement, because we're actually barking up the wrong tree there. So because we didn't focus on immigration so much, a lot of people call us liberal leavers, which is, we wouldn't all identify as liberal leavers, just people who don't really put immigration front and centre. For us, it's about the core issue of sovereignty and democracy, which brings us to the actual process of Flexit, was to actually end up with a complete reworking of the UK democratic system as an actual incentive to make all this Brexit worthwhile. Because there are prominent Remain voices, for instance, Dr. Mike Galsworthy of Scientists for EU. He said, as much as the EU is a problem, the bigger part of the problem is the people's own relationship with their government and what the government does on their behalf in Europe. And on that, we see
is
absolutely right.
British people or every group set of people throughout the continent? Mainly British people he's talking about.
Well, I limit this. I don't do comparisons with other countries. This is about our democracy, our country, and this is ultimately all the biggest ratchets in European integration have been the first big one, of course, was the single market, which this was a complete reinvention of technical law in the UK. That was done in a hurry, it was bodged, and it had an enormous impact on small to medium businesses, to an extent clearing them out of the way, so basically only the people who could afford to comply with the new regime could go forth and survive. So it, in a lot of ways, it felt like an oligarchy taking over UK business, and so that left a scar on the British psyche. And then, of course, there was Lisbon, which was railroaded without any real national debate, without any. We were promised that referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. We didn't get it, of course. There's this sense that that leavers are anti-immigration. Well, actually, it isn't that. It's the fact that the effectively the floodgates were opened without consent and without forewarning. And of course, this does have though sort of London is used to that level of influx. We've sort of seen very rapid transformations of the regions. And not all for the good, and not to everybody's benefit. And so there's all of these. It's not so much what the EU is and what it does; it's how our government goes about integration, lying to us, saying it's not going to do something, and then going ahead and doing it. And so, at the heart of the problem is a problem with our democracy. Government does things to us, it doesn't consult us, and we have no control over it. And if anything beautifully illustrates this, we don't actually know what Mrs. May is planning on putting in her speech for the 21st of September. But it could be a unilateral walkout. It could be a trigger to leave the single market, or it could be something completely out there. We don't know yet. But the fact is, we've got an executive in relation to Europe that is capable of doing absolutely anything it wants. And so, as much as leaving the EU is a question of democracy and sovereignty, it doesn't even begin to approach solving the bigger problem of how we relate with our own government. And so we believe the EU is a facet of that. And that leaving the EU is a precursor to starting a sort of democratic renewal process. And we will start to see, certainly through the process of leaving, just how creaking and inept that our safeguards and democratic controls are. The last year has been indicative in that our MPs have been so blissfully disengaged from what the EU does and how it works. It's only in recent weeks that you've actually seen MPs being able to tell the difference between things like the single market and the customs union, and even then they struggle with the most basic of terminology, and it's embarrassing that these people actually represent us. And they've not been tasked with anything of this kind of significance for, well, 40 years, for as long as we've been in the EU. And we've seen this political atrophy and this this really quite bizarre disconnect where, it's not called the Westminster bubble for nothing. These people don't relate to us, they don't represent us. And that is as much an urgency to fix as the fact that Britain doesn't really relate to the EU. It doesn't really it treats any news from the EU as foreign news, and it's always an abstract. And when it comes into Westminster politics, again, it's a domestic political device. So. You've got to look at it in the whole, and that's part of what Flexit was about. It was about the mechanics of leaving, and then it was the process of democratic renewal.
So you call for electoral reform, for example.
Yes. Typically, when we hear calls for electoral reform, we hear things like proportional representation, transferred voting. But all of this is really just tinkering with the means of selection. This isn't constitutional reform, and the base problem with tinkering with the means of selection is all it does, it addresses the voting rituals, but it doesn't address the nature of the word democracy from the Greek, demos kratos, which is people power. So we can tinker with the voting system, but at the end of the day, you've still got an MP who is in power for the next 5 years, and in between doesn't have to consult us at all. So we need constitutional safeguards, and certainly we had the In latter years, we had the referendum lock. Well, actually, we need mechanisms in place to make sure they never do this to us again, where they put Britain in a treaty arrangement where something like Article 50, it was always a risk that there could be a WTO-style collapse and walkout. Well, you know, that's an enormous point of failure. So it's putting all of our eggs in one basket. And they've actually, it was always, if you take the view that leaving was always a risk and to some extent an inevitability, signing up to Lisbon was a pretty dangerous thing to do because it's made a passport union, a customs union, a regulatory union, and the common commercial policy is taking a huge part of our foreign policy away from us and making us dependent on the EU. And all the time that the EU is doing that, we're dismantling our own domestic capacity. And the consequence of that is this political atrophy we've seen, where we just don't have a functioning political class, a government that is completely inept, out of its depth, and an opposition that's not actually that much capable of anything either.
We've had changing tack slightly, or maybe not. We've had Professor Patrick Minford on the show outlining his vision of unilateral free trade and how great it will be for everybody. I think that's probably not you don't share his viewpoint.
I view it as bad as the EU itself, because the process of Brexit is the process of repatriating decision making. And a lot of the decisions pertaining to trade are an exclusive competence of the European Union. And we notionally have treaty safeguards, but because trade increasingly covers matters of non-tariff barriers and regulation, we find that the ECJ is capable of making rulings to afford the EU more powers to trade on matters of regulation, and that's when we start seeing our own safety measures, our own regulations traded away as part of these mega international deals. And while the government itself may have a veto, the people themselves do not. So this idea that that it is a democracy it's a false one. Now, what Minford is effectively proposing is more or less the same thing, that we're just going to unilaterally open or let down all of our safeguards and just let the market choose. Well, again, you're surrendering the ability to make calculated decisions on what you're going to do with trade and what your trade policy is. And that, to me, is an abdication from statecraft, because really, trade is about picking your alliances, your partnerships, but also your foreign policy. It's got to be effects-based. We've heard ideas about reigniting the Commonwealth or having some sort of Anglospheric alliance with Canada, New Zealand, Australia. But these are all blue sky thinking that doesn't actually relate to our real world foreign policy objectives. Our shared foreign policy objective with our European partners in or out of the EU is slowing down the migrant crisis. So what's our policy on Eritrea? What's our international development policy? What is our trade facilitation policy? How are we going to increase the wealth of Africa and stabilize the governments and reduce the violence to slow down the influx of people? And trade is an absolute key tool. If you increase the trade, you increase the wealth. You want to be looking at good governance techniques, helping them meet the export standards so that they can trade with Europe and the United Kingdom. So all of these are calculated decisions, and we might actually want to decide that, well, actually we want to leave some tariffs intact to exclude certain other partners, specifically so we can increase trade with a chosen partner, because because we have a vested national interest in that nation becoming richer. Certainly the target with Kenya, over the last 20, 30 years, we've made this a priority of making Kenya an agglomeration hub and pouring lots of intellectual and financial efforts into making it a sustainable economy, which attracts people to go to Nairobi and the sort of population centres, rather than sort of moving north to come into Europe. So these are about what are your strategic objectives? Mm. And of course, Professor Minford comes from the school of unilateral free trade, very much of the hardcore libertarian ilk. Well, that deals only with free markets, but governance, good governance and statecraft thinks about things other than just GDP. For instance, if we open our borders entirely to any agriculture from anywhere, what impact is that going to have on UK agriculture? And in that, you've got to ask, well, what is the purpose of agriculture? Well, for the UK, it's not just about food production. It's about maintaining landscapes and maintaining traditions and heritage and all the things that make, think places like the Lake District, they look that way for a reason, mm-hmm. because of the paddocks and the sheep grazing. That's why you've got green and well-maintained sort of chocolate box landscapes. This is because we've got a protected, subsidised farming industry. And they are custodians of the land. And, of course, you've got families going back hundreds of years doing that. But we also want to look at, even if the UK is forced to compete globally in agriculture, there's no way it can compete. So there's a good chance that if we drop all of our defensive measures, then we have no agriculture at all. Now, your free marketeer would argue, well, that just refocuses your economy on things like services and banking, and you just, what do? Do you let the countryside go to rack and ruin? Well, I don't want to see that, and in fact, the fact that we have an arable sector in the UK is effectively our petri dish for agricultural technologies. In terms of machinery, trying out agricultural robotics, all of these are coming. All of these ideas are coming from UK agricultural colleges, and so we're a world leader in that sort of innovation in irrigation systems. So all of these, we have to use UK assets as a trial basis to see what works, and because we're a temperate climate, we're in a good place to be trying out all mm-hmm. these things. So it's not just about the GDP value and how much food we can produce at a certain price. Good governance recognises that everything is interconnected and you need a holistic trade policy. And trade needs to be part of your foreign policy, which is why we would advocate merging DFID with the Department of International Trade. So aid becomes part of the spearhead of your development policy, and that kind of development in itself will create opportunities for UK financial services, fintech, and scientific exports. So whenever you're looking at unilateralism, you're dealing with ideologues, and you're effectively dealing with a small hardcore band of Tory zealots from the sort of Institute of Economic Affairs, Adam Smith Institute. They've only ever read one book between them, and it's probably Ayn Rand or something, some other nonsense like that. And it's like religious zealots. Beware of men of only one book. A man who's only read the Bible is a dangerous man. Same as an economist who has only ever read Adam Smith is mm-hmm. equally dangerous. These are people who are blinkered by their own ideology. And that's not what Britain's about. Britain, Maggie Thatcher, she popularised the word statecraft, and that's the word I really do associate with with her rule, in that she was all about sort of advancing free markets, but there was still that sort of conservatarian upholding this notion of citizenship, making a contribution, and the fact that British citizens are not just grazing on the land as economic units, we are in fact custodians of something that something more that means something to us, which is why there's a sort of a spiritual aspect to Brexit as well, because we're talking about the safeguards against the ravages of hyper-globalisation. So we need the tools repatriated to decide, well, we want to be this buccaneering free trade nation, but we're not actually going to hand away all these powers and just let all of this happen at once. And that was our core complaint with the EU, and that's why we probably would have opposed TTIP. But then at the other extreme, you've got pretty much exact Minford proposing exactly the same thing. You know, just abandon trade policy, let the chips fall where they may, drop all your defensive measures. And of course, the absolute folly of that is once you've surrendered all of your defensive measures, what are you going to trade with?
You give a 21-point Twitter thread on why no deal will be disastrous. That's pretty proved quite popular. One thing I wanted to pick out from there is where you talk about the Open Skies Agreement, which we've never actually touched on in this podcast in over 100 episodes now, but all landing slots will be cancelled. It sounds more like carnage than chaos.
I'm certainly no expert in the Open Skies part of it.
But this is the idea that trading, we can fly and land our planes wherever, and it's
but, There is this fixation with talking about trade in goods, and we've had this ongoing argument with conservative leavers as to how trade in goods would be affected, whether lorries would be held up because of the absence of customs controls. Now, these are important debates, and we are of the view that actually without an agreement with the EU, then all of the current customs systems just cease to work. They cease to function because the UK is deleted from the treaties, deleted from the databases. We have no special privileges. So yes, trade in goods does come to a stop, but this myopia is focusing on just this one aspect, where the EU is much more than that. It's all the governance systems, and a single European sky is part of that. Open skies agreement and passenger rights, and whether an aircraft can take off from Heathrow, land at Schiphol, take on more passengers, and then carry on to its destination. We'd lose those rights overnight, and the schedules are planned months in advance. If we just pull the plug, then all of that just gets thrown up into the air. But then there's things like maritime surveillance, shipping, port state control, the international treaties that we are signed up to via the EU. We in some cases we're no longer signatories. So. A piece on EUreferendum.com last night suggests that as much as it's a customs union now, the EU is also a passport union. So if he's right, then actually if we pull the plug, then our passports are just, you know, bits of worthless paper. They don't actually mean anything. So we'd actually have to repatriate the system and renegotiate recognition of British passports in their own right. So there's all of these technical areas of governance, things like food safety, European Medicines Agency, all of the approval systems for pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, household chemicals, industrial chemicals, all our registrations and certifications and recognised approval bodies, all that just vanishes overnight. So it is important to talk about trading goods on the back of lorries going through the Channel Tunnel and across on ferries, but you know that's only a tenth of what the EU is. There are some hardcore leavers who think, well, whatever the problems are, we'll just let that happen, and then over the months and years we'll sort it out and we'll gradually return to normal. Well, firstly, why would you do that to yourself? Secondly, it's not just trade. One of the issues we've got is that the UK, as part of the customs union, is not a distinct customs entity. Thus, any trade agreements that the UK has with the rest of the world are presently EU agreements. We've heard quite a lot about having to carry over FTAs. Now, that is a difficult process in itself. And that's one the trade geeks are really going to have to get stuck into. But what is as important as FTAs is the cooperation agreements between things like the European Medicines Agency and the United States. I forget what their
pharmaceuticals,
FDA, yeah, that sort of thing. They've got cooperation agreements for gradually harmonising standards and methods and practices. And then, of course, you've got Europol agreements with police forces around the world. Colombia and Brazil have cooperation agreements with Europol in regard to narcotics. And then, of course, we've got the surveillance systems going into Africa because, you stop a container load full of pharmaceuticals coming in or out of Africa, there's a good chance that 70% of the produce on there is mislabeled, counterfeit, and very often dangerous goods. And there's all of these systems. There's something that I became aware of just recently. There was a case of an airline crashing somewhere in the Colombian mountains. And before the air accident investigators could get there, the local mafia bosses were out with helicopters dropping people off to salvage parts from the wreckage, because Miami is a global centre in airline spares, counterfeit and fraudulent goods. So by the time they actually got airline investigators in, think key things like the black boxes, the fasteners, the bolts, the wheels, any spares that could turn a profit, they just vanished from the crash site, and they'd end up on the market. So you need quality international intelligence networks monitoring not only organised crime but illegal trading goods, and for that you've got to have a close eye on shipping. And this is all about customs cooperation agreements, and there's just this massive tapestry of interagency cooperation that we would lose overnight.
We can't get that in place in the next 2 years, then. Well, 18 months or even less. I don't know, the clock's ticking.
Well, in theory, you could do it by... You would have to plan it in advance, and you'd have to pick up the phone and actually talk to the foreign ministries in every one of these countries and do it by exchange of letters to say basically where applicable. Where you currently talk to EU agencies, you will have the same memorandum of understanding with UK agencies. But in a lot of respects, because we have passed through the administrative abilities and powers to the European Union agencies, we don't even have those domestic competences anymore. So they might have a special office for liaising with the EU on matters of narcotics trafficking. Well, who are they going to talk to in the UK? It would be the UK branch of Europol, which of course evaporates overnight if we pull the plug. So there's all of these there's a whole universe of complex issues that cannot be addressed by a simple trade deal. And even if we did want to completely repatriate everything so that we had absolute sovereignty, we would have to rebuild our own domestic competences and gradually manage the process and bring these powers back. And we are going to have to do that with the express cooperation of the European Union. We are going to need an enormous amount of help from the EU, even from their own sort of legal core, just to put cases through the ECJ to decide what particular laws mean in particular contexts and if they can apply after Brexit, and whether or not the EU will want to retain some sort of supervision for the duration of the transition. So there's I can talk for hours on any given subject area, and there are distinct issues that unilateralism just doesn't even begin to address.
How long would you say then that this transition period needs? It's probably plucking a figure out of the air.
Well, everybody is in a rush to put a time limit on it, and I would argue that it takes as long as it takes. If you attempt to put sunset clauses onto things, and if you attempt to do everything all in one go, most likely you will fail. So we took the view that if we joined the EEA, that would immediately simplify the process, because for a transition, there's no way we're going to get a custom transition, so it would effectively be an extension of Article 50 talks, probably indefinitely, until there was a finished product for us to transition into. Now that's sketchy territory as to whether we'd be allowed that. So if we had any sort of specific framework, it would effectively be full EU membership, but without the voting rights. That would be the sort of transitional block before a new agreement kicked in.
So European Union would presumably be fairly happy with that, but then you would have plenty of people.
Well, that means in the meantime that the EU can do exactly whatever it likes in terms of its own development without the UK having a say.
Yeah, but so, many people in the UK are very unhappy.
And so then the alternative to that, of course, is the EEA. If you go straight into that, you don't really need that much of a transition agreement, in that the body of the core agreements, things like Open Sky, are covered under that heading, but it takes care of all the trade stuff as well. You could effectively recreate the customs union aspects as a country-specific protocol of the EEA agreement. So there's a possibility that we could maintain most parts of what's now called frictionless trade. And you effectively remove the uncertainty, and it makes for a lot easier transition, because the legal engineering, you can leave all the EU regulations in place because they have relevance to the EEA. And so the most appealing aspect of that is, rather than waiting in some limbo until an FTA is concluded, well, we've already got one, so we'd be out in probably 2, 3, 4 years, more likely 4, because we'd have to sort of negotiate with EFTA, and we might actually have to slightly re-engineer the EEA agreement. But it's the faster, safest way of getting out, and it removes the uncertainty, whereas if we're lingering in a limbo of this sort of quasi-EU membership until something else is concluded, well, there's a solid chance that any new FTA is going to take absolutely years to agree. If we came up with even the base outline of something that wasn't basically a facsimile of the EEA agreement, I'd be surprised if we could do that in 4 years. So that then means it can't be done before the next general election. Now, Labour would then, of course, run a general election campaign on, look at the absolute hash these guys are making of it, let us take control, and by which time we're starting to see some very serious consequences from the uncertainty. And I think by probably springtime next year, all those businesses that are waiting for some sort of message that things are going to be all right, they'll have concluded that we can't afford to wait anymore. There's investment decisions that need to be made. We need to decide if we're going to relocate, if we want to keep our just-in-time supply chains open. We're going to have to make these decisions. We're going to have to make them now. And since we haven't got anything concrete from the government, we're just going to go. Or just sort of disinvest from the UK. So that gives Labour a major boost. And so they can either argue for something else entirely. They could even argue for Remain. Or worse, they could take this non-voting transitional limbo that we'd be in, and then they'd just leverage it into some sort of association agreement, which would be Brexit in name only, and probably the worst of all worlds, because you've got no actual power in the decision making in the EU, still effectively doing as you're told. But politically, that would be so unbelievably toxic, because people would very much, half the country voted to leave the EU and would see very clearly that we're not going to leave. And so I think things could get very sour. So it's still hugely unpredictable as to which way it's going to go. And the Tories know full well they've got those sorts of pressures on them. Which could prompt them to do something monumentally stupid in the next few weeks. We don't know. Your guess is as good as mine.
So, monumentally stupid, as you put there, it sounds like you don't have a huge amount of faith in MPs. Think you'd believe they haven't got the first idea, really, of how the customs systems work. So, it's one I posited before on the podcast, but who should be in charge and driving this ship, if we're going to mix the metaphors?
That's a difficult question, because it would appear competence is not available to us. It would have been my preference that David Cameron had not resigned, because there was... Cameron was very much a Remainer, but he's had the experience in Brussels. He could tell you what a non-tariff barrier was and was able to acknowledge their existence, unlike half of the Tory backbenchers. And actually what we needed was some competent leadership, which we don't have from Theresa May. Well, you get rid of Theresa May, who else is there? Nobody. There's nobody that leaps to mind. Which is ironic at the moment, because the Tories who have my fullest attention at the moment, the people who I would trust not to make an absolute mess of this, is people like Dominic Grieve, with his legal experience, and Ken Clark, the arch Remainer, because he's always had a round grasp of the issues. And of course, if you want a successful Brexit delivered, you need realists, pragmatists, people who are willing to take the realities on as they are, rather than how we wish we are, wish they are. And that's not going to happen, though. And even that would not be satisfactory to quite a lot of leavers, well, most leavers, in fact, simply because those people are Remainers, and the trust has gone. Which kind of goes back to what we were saying about democratic reform. There is half of the reason we're seeing this rush to get out the door as quickly as possible is because from the get-go there's been this move to stop Brexit or to sabotage it, and that is just making the Brexiteers panic, and they're absolutely certain that even if they have to damage Britain to get it done, they still believe that that's the only course of action available to them. So in a lot of respects, if we end up with a disaster, then quite a few of the leading Remain figures will have had a hand in that. Not least because of a lot of the mythology spread about the so-called Norway option, that we would have no say in the rules and that we adopt all the rules and that we still keep paying into the budget. Of course, none of those things are actually true or are heavily caveated. And so the Remainers have managed to shut down what is a perfectly acceptable option. It's interesting, us as a more moderate campaign, we have the hardcore leavers and the hardcore remainers attacking us, saying exactly the same things. Mm. One group is saying, you know, if you want all of this stuff, then you might as well just stay in the EU. And of course, then you've got your hardcore leavers who think anything that isn't Ragnarok is still EU membership, so you can't win in either domain. But we are actually picking up a lot of traction. I've been all over London talking to people all week. My inbox has never been more full of people asking for more details about the Norway option, because I think people realise this is the last opportunity we've got to focus, the last chance saloon for a sane solution. And if we can't get the government to see sense, or if we can't get the opposition to make some sort of move to assert itself, even if that means bringing down the government, then we're going to be in deep trouble, because the whole process is being steered by the hardcore of the Tory Brexiteers. They themselves, they haven't the wit and the sophistication or the intelligence to realise things are more complex than they are. And then, of course, they've had the Legatum Institute, who've had their eyes on consultancy fees and influence inside the government. They've been casually stroking the people like Steve Baker for the last 12 months, whispering in their ears, telling them what they want to hear, that, oh, of course you can have a relationship based on fantasy mutual recognition agreements, and of course you can have frictionless trade without all the obligations. And so you're getting corporate think tanks with their own commercial agendas stroking the ignorance of the zealots, and they're the ones who are effectively pulling Mrs. May's strings. So we're in very dangerous territory here.
So then, just finally, Peter, and thank you today, it's been fascinating to listen to you. If we shouldn't turn to corporate think tanks, and the MPs don't know what they're talking about either, where should people go for more information? I did note a cheeky tweet from you this morning saying, if you want to get around the Financial Times paywall, just read some of the blogs they steal their journalism from. In terms of blogs, there's some good stuff out there.
We've caught the Financial Times red-handed raiding quite a few of the blogs, and this is one of the problems with UK media, is that they have walled themselves off, and they don't recognise that blogs are part of the media culture. And we're out there on the rim as if we don't exist. And it's only in recent months where the blogs have just increased in frequency and quality and intensity that I think we're getting to a position where people are no longer interested in the sort of Westminster and the London bubble debate that's full of errors, because Twitter is undermining that media narrative and actually saying, well, look, there's other options, there are other voices that we need to be listening to. And Professor Chris Gray and there's a guy called Tony Nogg, that they are hardcore remainers. And I will argue with them till silly hours in the morning, and we're never ever going to agree on EU membership. But these are bloggers, along with Steve Pearce and George Peretz. These are people who are engaging in the issues on a intellectually honest level, and these are people who've got some very useful things to say. But us on the Leave side, there's EUreferendum.com, Leave Alliance websites, which is leavehq.com, my own personal blog, and the Leave Alliance tweeters. We've got a network where it's just assumed if we tweet one of our own blogs, whether or not we actually read it, we just retweet each other's stuff. We are increasing our own web footprint. And that was always part of the original strategy, to make the sort of London media has its own gatekeepers of orthodoxy and controllers of narratives. And Faisal Islam is one of these types who's got his version of the gospel truth, and nothing exists outside of that.
He's the Sky political reporter.
Whereas there are other elements that desperately need to be injected into this debate. And through, because we could never actually change the minds of these single-minded journalists, we have, over the last year, been building our own constituency where people actually come to us for the information, and they're now, without us having to try, we actually have people going and attacking these journalists and MPs and saying, "Nah, you've got this wrong," or "Have you thought about this?" And so we're trying to steer and inform the debate and find new ways of putting new arguments in front of people and saying that actually, yeah, there's a way we can rescue Brexit, and it doesn't necessarily have to be this grand catastrophe, but what we need most of all is a bit of pragmatism, realism, and most of all some intellectual honesty.
Peter, thank you ever so much for joining us today. It's been great to spend a bit of time with you.